music that you maybe, I mean, sort of the kind of music that you play,
right,
you know, before your program.
Yeah.
He's into that.
He's into all kinds of variety.
Yeah.
The whole range.
There's a quite similar to the kind of things that you might pick, you know, to run. And does sort of a show like that. But, yeah, so it was interesting how these people who were a lot of, actually, when I think about it, a lot of the people that were, one of the women that was, the woman who was the chair of the board that was in there had been at CIUT.
Yeah.
So they had, they seemed to have associations with them.
Right.
It's all very cliquey, you know, the whole, this whole thing. As
yep.
things usually are, I guess.
You're reminding me of it all. I remember that. I even know who you mean, the board woman.
Yeah, right.
About.
You met her. Yeah, you
yeah,
met
I
her.
Met her. I don't know how she's doing. I proposed myself to be international rep to her.
That's right. You had to make a presentation to her,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. Then you we recorded and you played it.
That's right. That's right. Did we do that over the air?
Yeah, we played it over the air. That's October 2007, pretty sure.
Wow, that's a long time ago now.
But just to place it, are you, you got knocked off in 2006, right? And get back in
we,
the fall
we,
of 2007.
Yeah, we got, we were, yeah, we were, yep.
Yep.
We were marked, we were, I think it was October 2006, and then we got back on the air late 2007.
Right.
And then it all ended about, you know, maybe
February,
14
March 2009.
About 14 months later.
Yeah, when Dave was here. February, he closed
right.
it down again. February
right.
2009. And then
yeah.
then the February 28th, it was nothing on or something. And then it limped along for another year.
Wasn't our last show the 22nd of...
Yeah,
yeah.
The last show was the 22nd of 2009. and, you know, that's 3 weeks before Ion showed up. See, we put. I'm going to put that into the mythology. We closed down CKLN, and then Ion came forth.
Amazing.
Yeah, no, that I hadn't put that there. Well, maybe back then, but now I got it in my head. Yeah, and Neufeld
well,
had to be
a
part
wonderful...
of it. And now here I am. 11 years later, reminding everybody of the war wound. Dave Bernard versus Dave Neufeld, right there on the. On the class reunion.
And they won't allow you to do it.
Yeah, they won't let me say it.
How did you find that out?
Arella, when she posted the thing that I gave her, the John Cage. See, I was with her on the phone. She and I interviewed John Cage. And I got a
right.
document from John Cage. He sent me something, a McLuhan document, a rare thing he had. So either by her posting and saying my name, I get noticed automatically, or she's emailed me. I don't remember which, but that was earlier yesterday. And then I started reading it, and I said, oh, let me show these guys. Bob's Anachrony. Here's Mike Dyer's in the article, and that's the day that we started the famous Bob Show, June 17th, 1987. It was allowed to be up there for 5 minutes. Bye. No history, Bob. You're not part of our history.
Well, that's what they do. They just censor
yeah.
everything, the history. History has to be rearranged
I don't know Andy
for their benefit.
Andy Sokansky is a guy that Mike Dyer told me about. Maybe he was in the station in 85, 86 at one point. One time I saw him. I recognize him now, but he went to L.A. You know, he's been there a long time. And I don't know the guy, but if he's working on Dave Bernard information, he wouldn't have a very good image of me. You know?
Oh, Dave Bernard would be sending all kinds of things to this guy behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Going, you got to watch out for this guy. This guy is this. This guy is that. He destroyed CKLN. He's. well, that's what he did to it. You remember? Remember? Well, we knew about Bernard because. You informed us that Bernard was getting in touch with Mike Dyer, trying
yeah.
to get Mike Dyer to help him, give him information to get rid of us.
Yeah. That's right. I got heard. I got accidentally
I
got
mean,
into the loop. Yes.
He never. I mean, did Bernard ever think that by writing to Mike Dyer that somehow it would get back to us? He didn't, and it did.
Yeah.
And we had inside information about what this little snake was doing.
Right.
So many weasels. So many.
I could say, well, it's the nature of people with no money.
I guess so.
Scrounging, who don't want to work. A lot
but
of
Bernard stuff. Always struck me as someone who had money.
I don't know about that.
Well, I think he was well-to-do, or he made sure that he had access to funds and access to money.
Well, my last conversation with him was mid-90s. He was doing something for CBC in some booth, and I bumped in and we get talking. And he says, sorry to hear you and Carolyn got divorced. I said, what? He said, yep, that's what the word is. So they were smearing me back then that Carolyn left me 25 years ago.
I think he just lives in a world where he wishes things would happen.
Yeah.
And then he just pushes his wishes on the actual people. You know what he said to me? He said to me, like, this is a little sneak. He says, we're protesting CKLN. I can't remember what was happening, but he was hanging around where we were, and he says to me, "Oh, you should go and do what you're, you know, just stick to what you're good at."
And he says like, it
you
know, like
don't
that.
You're imitating
his voice pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. You should just stick to what you're good at. You know, animation. He was saying is, but this is what Bernard was doing. It was a double-edged sword,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He's saying, I know what you do for a living. And
yes.
I can, you know, I have connections, and I can make your life a living hell in your business. I can take your business. Why don't you just go off and do what you do in your business, and just stay out of this radio thing that you don't do very well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm good at radio, you know, but you're not.
What was amazing is you guys would be number two or three in the fundraising every year. That would
piss
them off.
Well, really, we were. I think there's only one person that beat us.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Was Benson?
Oh
Dave
yeah, didn't
Benson?
Yeah, didn't they kind
maybe.
Of? They you caught them playing with the figures.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. We did, and really, we were number one. We were number
well,
one.
Well, that's amazing.
If you took it all out, basically. What they did was, for instance, Ron Nelson.
Yeah.
We found out what they did with him. He was this. He started out as the hip hop guy, right?
Yeah, 1984.
Yeah, and then I guess he decided that there was more money in reggae dancehall, and made the move out of the or maybe he's getting his life threatened. Who knows? In the hip hop thing, it got too dangerous. So he switched out and did some other type of program and made a lot of money out of it, I suppose. And what was I saying about Nelson?
Bernard?
I can't remember where I was going with that, with him. What were you saying earlier, Bob? Sorry. It's getting late it's getting early in the morning.
Yeah, we should go out with a whimper.
We should.
We should have us just try to have brain fog here and then sort of go to music. Why are we on the air? Who are we talking about? I said, we were talking about Bernard, and then I discovered something, and then you remembered that, and the money. Yeah, they were rigging his...
Okay. What would happen was, when we first started doing the fundraising, which would happen in the fall every year, we'd come in on Sunday morning, and they'd say, "Okay, you know, International Connection has a quota to do. We want $300 or $400 or whatever out of your show." And we go, "Okay." But we'd come in, and everybody would be saying, "Oh, Ron Nelson did $23,000. on Friday night or something, you know, some huge amount of money, right? And everybody felt belittled or beholden somehow to Ron Nelson, who we never, ever saw at the station outside of the time he did his program. And if you weren't there during that, you never saw him.
Yeah.
But you'd hear, oh, Ron Nelson, you know, he's way ahead. He did this. It was like he was keeping the station afloat with the money he was bringing in. And we were all just, you know, pathetic peons that could only bring in a few bucks, right? So, anyway, this went on for years, and we would, you know, we'd do, I don't know, I seem to remember we would get up at about four, it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but we'd do maybe $4,000, something like that. We'd raise $4,000. Believe me, at CKLN, with some of the shows that would be on at better time slots, getting sometimes zero.
Yeah.
You know, $4,000 is a lot of money compared to zero. And so, anyway, at some point, we got access to actual figures. Oh, and every year, they'd have a meeting or something and say, oh, and special thanks to Ron Nelson and Reggae Mania for, you know, bringing in, you know, some vast amount of money, right? And they'd give, you know, the board of CKLN gives special honors to Ron Nelson for his great contributions and so on. So anyway, at one point we got actual figures. When I say we got, I mean, it wasn't like they were available, they gave us. Somehow we came across them, all right?
Yeah.
And what we found was that, yeah, Nelson had huge pledged amount of money.
But none of it came in.
But he would only be getting about 20% of that money.
Yeah, of completed pledging.
Yeah. In other words, people would just phone and say, oh, yeah, I'll pledge, you know, $6 trillion, you know. And then they'd go, okay, let's write up $6 trillion on the board. And he would get, his return rate was something like 20%. So all of this lauding of him as a great fundraiser was just complete fraud. And they knew it. They knew that he didn't bring the money in.
Right.
So we looked at the years that we had figures for. We saw we were way ahead of Nelson. We were bringing in far more money than Nelson was, because we were, our pledged money, we'd get 98% return on it. He'd be getting 20%. And yet they knew damn well what was going on, but they were trying to protect an image there, right? That, oh, this black man is keeping the whole station afloat. Isn't it great how wonderful the black race is, that, you know, there's all this racist stuff, really. All done by these white liberals. And of course, Nelson just went right along with it. He's like, hey, if they're going to say great things about me and I'm number one, well, who cares, right? But he knew damn well he wasn't bringing the money in. But he was bringing it in for himself.
Yeah.
So, and they were all thick as thieves there. And
let's end with that.
Yeah. Okay, Bob.
Okay, let me think. Do you have any music you'd like to play? I'm going to play another Ion recording eventually. But anything you want to hear? Think of anything?
Well, I like the stuff you play. I mean, what, like something? What era? What era do you play? What
every
is the,
era.
What is
everything.
Your favorite era?
Well, my favorite is Zappa.
Yeah, I know.
I can't play them all the time. So no, I have no favorites. I like I got a Count Basie. I have a Count Basie I started off with today. You know, that's the 40s and 50s or 60s. And then Jaco Pastorius, a famous bass player in the 80s. Then Andy Stokansky's Baba Mal and Wanzer Zek, African people. and Ray Stevens.
Ray Stevens?
Yeah, you want to hear him do Misty?
Misty? Is that Ray Stevens, the one that did the joke songs?
Yeah. That's well, what you want to hear, don't you?
Sure, I mean, what does he do? He does a version of Misty?
Yeah. I'll play it out.
Okay,
stay on the air. We'll see what you think.
I'll hear that.
Yeah, I'm going to do it now. You stay. Don't hang up.
Okay.
We'll see what you think.
Okay.
Look at me, I'm as helpless as a kitten love tree. I'm walking on the cloud, I can't understand love. I missed it holding your hand. Walk my way, and a thousand violins began to play. Or it might be the sound of your hello. You can say that you're leading me on, but it's just what I want you to do. Don't you notice how hopelessly I'm lost? That's why I'm following you. Ooh, on my own. Should I wander through this wonderland all night? Never know my right foot from the left. Too much in love. You can say that you're leading me on.
How was that?
He's kind of channeling Slim Whitman there, isn't he?
Yeah.
I've never heard that before.
It's nice.
That was pretty good.
Yeah. So I thought of a closer. What are you seeing about Doug Ford? What's happened? It's been a week?
Yeah, nothing much. He's just saying, we're right shoulder to shoulder with Trudeau about being anti-Trump.
Oh, he's anti-Trump?
Well, he is about the trade stuff.
Oh, yeah. Because on one of the leftist Facebook pages in Toronto, I posted the fake eyebrow that Justin got caught with.
Yeah.
Okay, so I posted that, and somebody made a snark. Maybe I should read this to you. Sort of cute. Okay, bring this up here. This is my interaction with another part of Toronto. I never leave where I come from. Wherever I've been, it's like music. I've got all the decades here. I don't abandon any decades. So I'm still in touch with people I knew 20, 50, 60 years ago. Okay? So this guy, very important person in the arts community, Right, so I post the eyebrow falling off of Justin Trudeau. So this guy says, we in the biz call it bad lighting. And you can say a lot of negative things about Justin's leadership, but he's not a fake. Okay? So he Trump's a fake. So I say, that's Justin's problem. He doesn't know how to be a true fake. He's still being a genuine fake.
It's amazing how protective these people are of Trudeau. It
right.
It's so pathetic.
So then I said, a politician has to be a complete foolish fake to get elected. Not a genuine fake or true fake. You've got to be a foolish fake. And I go, that's what the Android meme demands today. So then I said, second email or post on his site, which all the lefties there in Toronto, including the person that Ken Starr was photographed with, they're all reading this. And I'm some stranger. And so I go, by the way, Paul, nobody on the Canadian art or culture scene understands this pattern, and this explains why the Canadian artistic responses to the Don Trump probe are so forlorn, futile, and anemic. If your colleagues keep up with this myopia, there's no doubt Trump will invade Canada, and you can probably guess who will assist him. Okay. So I'm referring to Doug Ford. But this guy goes, Bob, you wouldn't. He thinks I'm going to help Trump invade Canada. And then, so he says, the second last time Benedict Arnold led the troops along with a fellow called Montgomery, we crushed him then, War of 1812. As Trump pointed out, we were forced to burn the White House twice. The building was painted white in an effort to conceal the humiliation. What Yankee versions of the story usually omit is the fact that the British and Canadian troops were aided in their attack by local slaves who were well aware that the great American democracy was based on genocide and trade in human lives. And your broad-based silly opinions on the Canadian culture scene betray the fact you have lived in Hawaii far too long. You need to come home for a bracing winter experience and a dose of Canadian humor.
No, you don't.
That will set you straight. Okay?
No one deserves that.
Right. And so then I write back, me? No, I meant Doug Ford would assist. And then I said, obviously you require a break on Maui. So I'm actually inviting him to come to Maui, so we'll see how he reacts to that.
One parting thing. Last week and I could go on forever about this, but last week, of course, was the great Trump-Kim summit.
Yes.
But in the aftermath of that, and I don't know whether you've seen this, but I think it was on Friday morning, Trump had this impromptu news conference out on the White House lawn. Did you hear about this?
I don't think so.
I haven't had time to go and find the whole thing, but the parts I saw live of it, for instance, he comes out and says, look, he says, you know, Crimea is part of Russia. You know, they speak Russian there. It's part of Russia. And they're just, everybody, all of the press are just completely stunned. And then they say to him, you know, and they have all these rhetorical questions that they're used to, you know, so lazy, right? The press is so lazy. And they come to him and they're talking about the DPRK, they call it North Korea, and they said, they're talking about Chairman Kim, and they go, he kills his people. They just blurt out stuff like that. He kills his people. And Trump goes, I'm not even going to address that. I thought, oh, great. Because they were just stunned that he wouldn't say, yeah, he kills his people. He won't even go that far anymore. And he had to go along with them. They just go, he kills his people, and then they expect that the person they're interviewing is going to go on for about 10 minutes about how deplorable this person is, right? And Trump goes, I'm not even going to address that. And they move on, and they... And just, you can see the looks on their faces. They're just completely stunned by his. They can't go there. They got to find something else to ask him. And he just keeps. And he says, at one point in an interview earlier in the day, he says, when Chairman Kim speaks, his people sit up and take notice. He says, that's what I want.
I see that. I was just looking at that. It says, President Trump declared a spur-of-the-moment interview with Fox and Friends Friday morning that he wants people to sit at attention for him like they do for North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. Wow.
And I'm thinking, yeah, he's got the idea. He's got the right idea now.
He's actually listening to you. You guys like the dictator, the Korean dictator.
Yeah. No, we don't call him a dictator. We don't call him a dictator.
What is he?
Well, he's not a dictator. He's the leader. He's the leader, right. He's their supreme leader. Yeah.
So you agree with Trump learning from the North Korean leader.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Here we go. Now we will be censored once again.
Well, I mean, you have to say somewhat sensible things. People aren't going to be listening to you and paying attention if you say idiotic things.
Right.
Which, you know, Trump sometimes says pretty idiotic things. But the thing is that when, do you know that, speaking of, Kim Jong-il, the leader, the present leader's father who died a few years ago, do you know he only said two words in public the entire time he was, chairman? Yes. He only said two words. He never made a speech. And what were the two words?
I don't know what they were.
He just said, literally, he only said two words.
And he was in power for like 20 years or something?
I think he came to power in 1994. And he died in, maybe a little less than 20 years.
Right.
And, he only said two words.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. But in a way, that's great, because a lot of people don't want to hear these people drone on about things, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he took it easy on the people there. He didn't go up and make speeches.
He didn't inflict the fallen condition of man on fellow men.
No.
Look what it says about your press conference. It says, it was just one of the surprising things the president said in the roughly 50 minutes he spent on the White House lawn speaking to the Fox News show and other reporters in a surprise appearance. The spur-of-the-moment White House lawn interview was, in the memory of those present, unprecedented. Here are the highlights from Friday morning surprise free-for-all press availability and TV interview. He praised strong Kim Jong-un. He defended Kim's human rights record. Boy, now let's go over to Ron Rosenbaum's tweets. Now, he's a famous lefty journalist in New York. He calls Trump, in every tweet, a crime family. And he says, how can this guy, you know, be coddling dictators and doing all these horrible things at home? So these are like the most extreme things that he could say. Let's see. He says, I camp back on June 15th. Well, today's the 16th, Bloomsday. Can't believe our media companies had the budgets to fly crews and hosts and reporters all the way to Singapore to cover Trump's stagecraft, yet refused to send staff to our own southern border to record these ongoing atrocities to humanity, you know, the separating of children from their parents. He wants that covered. Let's go further down here. He says, wouldn't it be sad if the entire Trump family was put behind bars for illegal activities of their phony charitable foundation? No chance for pardon. Sorry, Eric. Sorry, Trump Jr. Sorry, Ivanka. This is New York State, not Fed matter. No pardon. So that's his thought for the day. It'd be sad. If he's pretending, mocking that, it would be sad.
Well, they were talking. I can't remember. I was at a conference today, actually, about the DPRK situation with people who are sane. So there's none of this nonsense going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, the press, for instance, says, you know, oh, he's got these, you know, they have gulags there. They call them gulags. And I don't think they know what goes on there, and I don't think they know how many people are in prison. But it's almost like countries that they don't like evidently there can be no crime in those countries either, and that they're not allowed to have prisons, and that everybody that's in a prison in a country like that shouldn't be in prison. Meanwhile, in the United States, fully 1% of the population is in jail, which is a percentage that is the highest than in any country in the world.
Yeah.
And yet, these people have the nerve to put forward that the DPRK is somehow a terrible place that has gulags, when the United States has the largest prison population by percentage of the population of anybody.
Yep.
So it's all, there's no self-reflection about their own things. It's always out there sniping at somebody selectively, right? It's always,
yeah.
you never hear them call the Saudi prince, you never hear them call him a dictator.
No.
But, I mean, he really is a dictator.
Yeah.
And
he owns the United States.
He's the major owner
of the United States.
Yeah, of course you can't call him a dictator, right? But where, you know, a country that they've been sanctioning for the last 50 or 60 years and have stopped them from having any financial play in the world, then you can call them a dictator because, well, you're not making any money from them, right? You're stopping them. Do you know that I did some research. This is by South Korean reports, which I don't know whether they're reliable or not, but there's $10 trillion worth of mineral resources estimated in the DPRK.
Yeah, you were mentioning it last week.
$10 trillion. And you know that there's fully 60%, like of a certain type of mineral or commodity, that they have 60% of the world's supply.
Right.
So, you know, that's why Trump's saying, oh, you know, there's going to be a lot of money made there. Because I figured they need the stuff that's there now, and they want to get in line.
Right.
And he's being a businessman. Trump's being a businessman. That's what this is all about. He's not looking at it the way these other people looked at it. He's looking at trade, right, which is business, inter-country business, and he's trying to get control of it by having direct talks with various entities rather than having these massive trade deals that you know with omnibus trade deals with all these countries that the country eventually can't figure out what they're doing with whom.
Right.
And also, they had bad trade deals with other countries because the United States wanted to have military control over certain places and have special dispensation, and they sort of gave them good deals on things so that they could, for access into their, to put the military in and so on, to bribe them. And I think Trump is realizing at this point that he's looking at the balance sheet and he's going, this isn't making any sense anymore.
Right. Okay, so here's Ron Rosenbaum, who would agree with everything you say. He was an anti-American leftist journalist, so he'd go on about the prison population. But Trump has so screwed up his head, he says the other day, Mr. Trump, it was thanks to your cruel, corrupt steal from the poor, give to the rich tax cut, and your complicity with a criminal he's addressing Paul Ryan, the leader of the Republican Party, whatever it is, it's stepping down.
Oh, yeah.
The Speaker of the House. So it was thanks to your cruel, corrupt steal from the poor and give to the rich tax cut. Now, it was your corrupt steal from the poor, give to the rich tax cut, and your complicity with a criminal president of the United States who sold out our country to finance Moscow casinos and sucks up the North Korean generals who murdered Americans. You are a disgrace.
Wow.
You spit on the flag. Anyway, he goes on and on every day about this extreme dictatorship happening in the United States. He doesn't understand what you're saying about Trump.
Well, he's confused. This guy's confused.
Yeah.
I mean, for anything he actually has a handle on, he's confused about almost everything surrounding it. People can't say in the United States they like Kim Jong-un or that they respect him or what's gone on the DPRK. They can't. And all this human rights violations, I want to know what they are. What are they talking about? They never, ever say what they are.
Well, I don't know. I don't follow it. But they say that he kills his people. He kills a lot of his people.
Yeah, but they have no proof of that.
Hmm.
They have absolutely no proof of any of this. And the thing is that, well, I mean, we could have said that about Obama. Right? The thing is, we have black people getting shot in the streets. We've got people being murdered left, right, and center. Little children being murdered in schools. I mean, why? I mean, if that were happening if they knew that was happening or something like that was happening in the DPRK, they'd say, oh, it's all President Kim's fault. But if it happens in the United States, they don't go, oh, this is Obama's fault. He's killing his own people because of, you know, conflating it in some way. They don't say that. If people die in America, they don't usually say, the president did that. But if it's in some country you don't like, then it's everything that goes on there is the responsibility of the leader, that he's got control over everything. It's like Putin. They say he debunks this. He says, do you think I have a, like they say, oh, you did this and you did that and so on and so forth. And he goes, do you really think I have time to sort things like that out? He says, I've got a big job here running this country, and I have to delegate a lot of responsibility. He says, do you think I would have time to do what you're saying that I'm doing? Because it's just ludicrous. And it's the same in the DPRK. I mean, there's delegation of responsibility. There has to be. I mean, it might be that on important issues, President or Chairman Kim decides an important thing. But of course, you see, he can do things. You see, in America, it takes a long time to get something done. You know, things that would seem to ordinary people to be sort of simple decisions have to spend years being discussed, and then elections happen, and then change of government and so on. Well, that doesn't go on there, right?
It's right.
And the thing is, I was at the conference today. They were saying something that, see, Trump is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States. So when he goes over there to Singapore and he says, all right, we're going to stop these war games, and in Trump's words, he said, they're expensive and they were provocative. I mean, that's unprecedented for an American president to say that what they were doing were just open provocations for war. But the thing is, he has the right as president. One of the rights he has, one of his sort of supreme leader rights, is that he's the commander of the armed forces. So he can say, I'm stopping those war games, and they stop.
Mm.
Because he is the commander-in-chief. He doesn't have to go to Congress and say, oh, I'm going to beg them to stop the war games. About that, and certainly, and maybe even about signing a peace treaty, maybe. Mm. He alone can decide that. But, and the thing is, he can deal with Chairman Kim, because it doesn't have to go through a lot of channels. A decision to do something, the movement about these talks, which I'm sure are very complicated, but even so, they're able to get done because Chairman Kim can decide to do things. He doesn't have to go through what appears to be a huge protocol.
Right. No, I get that. So I want to say this, though. You were talking about Trump saying that you get people to sit at attention. So Rosenbaum sees this. And 22 hours ago, he says, imitating imitating Trump. He goes, you out there, yes, you, sit up straight at rigid attention. That's all in big capital letters. And then Ron says, a North Korean mass murdering dictator has his people sit at attention for him, and our criminal degenerate president thinks he deserves the same respect. That's Ron.
This guy.
He's a famous journalist who does very good in big books.
He doesn't know anything. This is just rhetoric. Because the thing is that they have in the I just at this conference in preparation for it, I helped one of the people put together a PowerPoint presentation, and what it was a bunch of slides showing posters made in the DPRK about propaganda posters, right? I mean, essentially, of one sort or another. They're all about all kinds of different topics. And, there are the ones about crushing America, crushing imperialists, so on and so forth, right? But then a lot of them are about social issues, about swimming. That we should all learn to swim, or we should all play basketball, or you should respect the revolutionary elders. You got to teach that to the children that, it was important what they did and so on, and keep that going. Or we should wear our traditional dress, or we should be playing traditional games and things like that, upholding our traditions and so on. I mean, this is you can sort of tell a lot by the propaganda that that is put out there, what kind of society it is. And it's a society that is, it's a conservative society, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's one that is very traditional in nature, in the sense of Korean tradition. It's also revolutionary at the same time. It's also trying to instill in the public that they're not going to put up with any guff from other countries and interference from other places. And they have to work hard at that. They have to instill this in the people. You look at America, it's not as clear what kind of values are being instilled in America because most of the propaganda is advertising.
Yeah.
Corporate advertising. And some of the things and when you think of the way that there's a lot of fiery rhetoric comes out of the DPRK about, what they're going to do to America and so on. But the same things go on in the United States. I mean, Lindsey Graham, I'll be charitable and call him effeminate. This strange figure, fey figure, coming out and saying that, that they're going to unleash war on this country and demolish it. It's just silly.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that the people there have to put up with this kind of stuff.
I mean,
in that kind of way where, although they do have posters of, of the Statue of Liberty being destroyed and things like that, right? I mean, it's sort of understandable in the sense that they had their country completely destroyed by America, whereas America has never had to suffer that on the homeland from, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, anywhere near it. They've never had to really suffer at home and beyond the people that they sent over there to invade the place that died. And I learned something else interesting about speaking of that, how they were talking about repatriating bodies from the DPRK?
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
One of the conditions was that they would be repatriating bodies from the Korean War, Americans.
Yeah.
Well, at the conference today, they talked about that, and a huge number of troops during the Korean War were kind of stuck there, American troops, got stuck in this place, very dangerous place within the DPRK, and I guess a lot of them got massacred there because they just got stuck there. They couldn't get out. Their supply lines were cut, and they couldn't get food and stuff, and you know, they suffered a big disaster there. Evidently, they buried in a mass grave their own people because they couldn't get them out. They couldn't get the bodies out. And so the Americans actually, like, they did the mass grave of their own people.
Yeah.
And then the survivors somehow got out of there. And nobody knows, they didn't know there, the person who was telling this was a Korean who had lived there at the time. And anyway, he told a story that, do you remember the Ross Perot situation?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember around 1991, I was in the United States listening to radio there, do you remember all that talk about the MIAs in Vietnam?
Yeah.
And how Perot or Bo Greitz, who was an associate of his, was suggesting that there were people actually alive being held in concentration camps in Vietnam, that Americans, that they were trying to get out of there, and somehow Bush was stopping it or wasn't admitting to it or something. And it was a bit of a campaign issue, especially on AM radio in America. And people were talking seriously about this, that there were still people being held prisoner in Vietnam.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I don't think anything ever came of it, to my knowledge. But anyway, around this time, evidently, two senators that were involved with Perot were trying to get through to the DPRK. But of course, there were no channels to do that. So evidently, they came to Toronto, and the guy who ran the Korea Times newspaper in Toronto had, for some reason or another, had channels to the DPRK, which is kind of unusual. A lot of the people that come here are very anti-communist. Seems like he kept channels open with the government there, and he arranged to get them to look for people, Americans, in the DPRK to send back to America, and they agreed to do it. But they said, oh, we'll send teams in to dig up your land. And they go, no. No one is going to come here and start digging in our country. We'll do the digging. You stay home, we'll do the digging, right? There's digging to be done, we're doing it. So, anyway, they were expecting that they were going to get a mother load, right? There were going to be thousands of bodies. I don't think they were thinking of anybody being alive being held by them, but that they were going to get lots of bodies. So the DPR came back and said, "Okay, we've done the digging and everything, and we've found them." He says, and they go, "Well, how many have you got?" And he says, "Two." He found two, and it was far away from this area that they had been in, you know, far enough away, but the guy who was telling the story said, you know, Toronto played a part in this early dialogue between the United States and the DPRK. But it was I thought it was interesting. It reminded me of the whole Ross Perot thing and how, and they wrote books, a book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye, which I have, written by some Canadian spy guy, who I think was born in England, and he was claiming that there were all these people who were alive and being held in by the communists there and so on in Vietnam. But I think it was all just lies.
Okay, so I've got to start my recording in the next few minutes. So let's see.
How long are you going to be up now, Bob?
Well, I'll be up for, personally, I won't go to bed for another 9 hours.
Wow.
I don't go to bed till 8:30 or 9 in the morning.
All right.
So thanks a lot for all the enhancement of the themes that entered my life the last 24 hours. And
yeah.
I'll have to figure out what to do with this recording. Maybe I'll talk to you about it privately, what we said, what can go out, what can't go out.
Oh, okay. Well, we might have to edit this one, huh?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
All right.
But
okay.
The what was the name? Who put on the conference you went to?
It was, the comrades an organization called Science for Peace.
Oh, okay.
And it was the Korea Truth Commission Canada branch.
Right.
Of which the comrades are involved with.
Okay, great. So
yeah.
There you have people, the last communists on Achieve Radio. Greg Duffel, using the old.
Well, we're all together now, right? Trump, and Kim Jong Un. We're all together. He's got better relations with Trump, with Kim Jong Un, than he's got with Trudeau.
That's right, right. Which is upsetting a lot of paradigms. So
yeah.
Look forward to more upset from Mr. Trump.
Yep.
And
he's a disruptor.
Right. So I guess that's it.
Yeah. Okay.
What you added to and reminded me of a lot of the themes of the last 20 years at CKLN, CIUT, so we now have it on record.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bob.
All right, great. So I'll talk to you soon.
And good night to Carolyn and your fine group of listeners there.
Yes. you're very popular among them, Greg.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I like to be popular. It's nice to be popular with somebody.
Yes, yeah. It's not being a comrade. You don't get many comrades to work with.
Oh, no.
Okay, talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, that was Greg Duffel with his report from Toronto. And we're going to now listen to Advanced Technologies and ION talking about this the day before the Vampires recording on January 8th, 2010. So this is session 232 back in, 8 years ago. Here we go.
Okay, so I'll just leave. So I'll just leave with that. So here's this article that I think someone sent me. What's interesting is published in the Honolulu Times, the Honolulu Examiner or something.
Boy, that's a timely newspaper herald, isn't it?
What, Honolulu
Times?
Oh, yeah, Times, right. But the point is, Honolulu, now, Carol, there seem to be journalists, or the Honolulu paper, even though it says Honolulu, but it's called examiner.com, and it says something about Seattle. I can't figure out what it is.
Well, good, that's all right.
Yeah, but the point is that these articles keep getting posted in Honolulu by people associated with the Project Camelot, the Bill Deagle world, Carolyn. They seem to have access to this newspaper and get their stories out, and they're related to the kind of stuff talked about on Project Camelot. So there's this guy, I think he's the author, Alfred Weber. Now, you recognize that name, Carolyn? Alfred Weber?
No.
Okay, he's Jim George's hero. He's the guy that Jim George worked with, 5-7 years ago when he was in Toronto and was doing some UFO disclosure stuff and all that.
Huh.
Alfred was his main guy, and he was employed by him or doing something with him. Okay, you finished?
Yeah.
Okay, so Alfred seems to be the author of this. So here's what it says. Second whistleblower emerges to confirm reality of time travel. It says a second whistleblower, this one a physicist, has emerged to confirm the existence of U.S. government development of time travel technology, and he emphasizes the importance of the real-world application of such technology for achieving planetary sustainability. Dr. David Lewis Anderson, director of the Anderson Institute, emerged publicly in a two-hour interview on December 23, 2009, to give an extensive account of his time control research for the U.S. Air Force, which he later continued at his time travel research institute and other organizations. Dr. Lewis's? Okay, this is David Lewis Anderson. Now they call him Dr. Lewis, but same guy, Lewis Anderson. Dr. Lewis's public revelations regarding time travel followed disclosures made in August and November by Andrew D. Baziego in interviews concerning his experiences in time travel experiments undertaken by DARPA. They're the ones who create the Internet. By DARPA's Project Pegasus, or Pegasus, in the early 1970s.
Pegasus.
A September 15, 2009 report derived from the WebBot, predicted that a planetary whistleblower would emerge from the current period of U.S. financial collapse. Now, we've brought up this guy before. WebBot is CliffHighHalfHuman.com, who do the computer pattern recognition that Ion brought up. The original version of that, I think Cliff High and them do a deviation of it, right? Or anyways, so Cliff High...
Abstract regarding it.
Yeah, now Cliff High, Carolyn, is the guy who wrote that put-down of Bill Deagle. Remember you read it and said he has to not agree. He says that Bill Deagle's talking bullshit. Remember that, Carolyn?
Yeah.
Okay, that's Cliff High. This article is talking about him. And these are fringe guys, so to speak. Cliff High, it says the Cliff High, the genius behind the WebBot, where they analyze chat rooms and find patterns of what's coming, determined that the individual is very likely Mr. Baziego. So, a lawyer from Washington State who is leading a truth campaign to establish that the U.S. defense community achieved teleportation in the late 1960s. Now, let's just stop there, Ion.
All right, what you want to know? Diane Wyoming.
Yes, teleportation was achieved in the 20s and 30s in Germany with the Jewish scientists in the Third Reich, and they carried that on to Area 54 and Pentagon, and probably it was well before the late 60s, correct?
No. Yes, it was a little before that. It wasn't mastered because they were afraid of it. They didn't have the... There was so much radiation involved, it was ambient, but at that point it was still causing issues because they were afraid of it. But they fine-tuned it... your fella at NASA, the German...
Wernher von Braun.
That's the one. Had to work out some bugs.
Yeah, and he died in 69, so he worked out the bugs before then.
That's correct.
And then they...
And that project is housed in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
That would be... They use technology. It's almost like Fringe. They had some technology that had radiation and all that to do this, right?
Well, yeah, that was the problem with the Germans' teleportation process, too. You got too hot. Your cells got too hot because you had issue with it.
Like David Roberts in Fringe, the guy who got diseased. You know, David something Roberts. David Roberts Jones.
That was the example. It's not like that.
No, but that's a metaphor in the Fringe series of what actually was an issue 40 years ago, in 50 years ago. What?
Yeah, wasn't it?
Now, an issue. It's still an issue, or it's always the now, when you're saying
it's
now?
Always the now.
Right. So what I get from that is
because
that...
Now, wait, stop. This is good. Carolyn, this may be the example you're asking for. Okay, there's an article. There's someone has something to say. They have empirically referenced it to the point that they felt comfortable to write it down and attach a name to it, of what was, as though is, was from a different stance of knowing of what that was. You see, they've cleaned up now what happened then.
Yeah.
Because then is only now. Because until the now became empirically referenced, there was no then to prognosticate regarding.
Right, there was no late 60s experiment until now could somehow have the experience now.
Thank you.
Yeah, and then have to always refer to the previous thing, or so you wouldn't have known, can't know it.
If that didn't happen until now, how would you find it to be give reference to validate it or straighten it out?
Right, and it always involves the future, too.
Well, that's not.
That is part of the now.
Tomorrow is the holiday that never comes.
All right, so I got this idea that what happened in the Third Reich is that the Nazis and the scientists around there started to see these things. but were intimidated or different aspects, and it took them another span of nows to work it out. So the American, the Pentagon developed in the 50s and 60s what was it glimpsed in the 30s and 40s, correct? You agree with that, Avaton? Ion?